Welcome to the Portion Podcast, a weekly discussion of the Torah portion of the week. I'm your host, Aaron Roller, here with my co-host, Rabbi Jonathan Bienenfeld.
And what you didn't mention is that I am super thrilled to both be your co-host and also to be here.
I don't want to be presumptuous.
Well, then let me share with you that I'm super thrilled to be your co-host and to be here.
That's so nice. I generally assume that you're here with, like, you know, some reticence and you know, some minor misgivings.
No. The only difference is that usually I'm here with proverbial bells on, and this week I'm here actually with bells on. Did you see the hems on my pants here?
Oh, is that what that
those are bells.
That tinkling sound was?
Yeah, that's why there was a tinkling sound when I was walking around your house before.
I got it. Okay. I'm glad that you've taken them off. Is that a move to kind of emulate the Kohen Gadol?
That is exactly what it was. I was trying to conjure up themes of the Kohen Gadol.
I don't know if it's so topical because this week's parsha I don't think has anything to do with the priests or the oh it does. What am I saying? It's like the very very beginning. There's some okay.
So Bikurim.
So we are exactly we are in. So let's get up to speed here. We are in Parshat Ki Tavo. We're getting in. We're in the bottom half of Sefer Dvarim here.
Yeah.
And Moshe's speech is winding down.
Winding down.
And after the cavalcade of Halacha last week, this week is notable largely for its. Introducing the theme of the blessing and the curse, command that it's interesting because I think that a lot of times when I read this, it sounds like it's happening like right then and there, but it's actually not. Moshe is saying, when you get into the land of Israel,
right,
this is what you should say. And he like,
on two particular mountaintops.
Right. Stand up on Har Eval and
Har Gerizim.
And Har Gerizim, right? And,
which is why to this day, well, I don't know about to this day, but there is a small community on the top of Har Gerizim that is actually called Har Bracha.
Right.
Because it was the Mountain of Blessing.
And you and I visited there, actually.
We did, and we bought some mean tahina, if you recall.
That's right. So the Samaritan community, the Shomronim, live up there, and they have a tahina factory, and we saw all the sesame seeds. Interesting fact, the sesame seed is not native to Israel.
They do not grow in Israel.
Very popular Middle Eastern food. It actually is grown in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
But they take them and turn it into some really, really delicious tahina. Anyway, so yeah, Moshe says, when you get into the land, go up on these mountains, and Rashi really paints the picture of what it was supposed to look like. It sounds extremely performative in the sense that the half the nation would be, six tribes would be standing on one mountain and six tribes would be standing on the other. And the leaders of the people will be standing at the valley in between the two mountains and kind of shouting out, turning to Har Gerizim and saying, these are the blessings if you follow the Torah. And everyone on both mountains, I think, yells, Amen. And then they would turn to Har Eval and say, and these are the curses which happen if you don't follow the Torah. And it's quite a dramatic scene to imagine.
Great theater.
And I guess one that, the nearest thing is we'll be having the Siyum HaShas coming up soon with stadiums full of Jews and rabbis and encouragement. But so that's a big part of this week's Torah portion, but it probably behooves us to speak about the very, very first thing. Ki Tavo means when you come in, and it's talking about when you come into the land, when the people come into the land, that they have the commandment to bring their first fruits to the Beit HaMikdash. And this was actually, if I am remembering correctly, the topic of your very first sermon at the Young Israel of Cherry Hill.
Is that true?
I think I moved in to Cherry Hill a week after you did, but I think you didn't give a drusha the first week. I don't know, my first week in Cherry Hill.
That's a great idea. I was in the community and I didn't give a drusha.
I think people were like, you just moved in.
Sounds like a great idea.
Maybe
we should go back to that system every now and again.
Maybe Kitese was the first drusha you gave, but certainly the first one I heard you give, my first week here, and I think it was the first one you gave, was talking about Bikurim and talking about the pageantry of it all. Also sure. highly performative and exciting.
Big time.
That basically you had a national parade, essentially, of people marching through the country with elaborate, all the farmers marching through with elaborate baskets and people lining up to see them and cheer them on, and the aspect of I remember, see, this is, our listeners should take note. I really do pay attention.
All right, this is flattering.
That you spoke about how the encouragement, the parade-like festival-like atmosphere was not mandated in any way, but that creating excitement around mitzvahs, especially when people are marching for days on end to get to Jerusalem, was really important, and that we have to do things in our religious lives to make it feel exciting. And it's not just about doing the bare minimum or going by rote, but rather that we have to really jazz it up and make it exciting.
Yeah, wow, great job. There's one other point that I think is worth mentioning, which is that
I may have dozed off during that part.
No. That just that there is specific rabbinic dispensation, which is very unusual, but specific rabbinic dispensation for employees to leave their places of employment in order to go and take part in all of the festivities, basically in order to go and greet all the farmers who are bringing the Bikurim. So there's all this hoopla surrounding this procession, this parade of people bringing their first fruits. But that in a halachic capacity, we say that despite the fact that you're really mandated to stay at work, and we're very, very concerned about the idea of people being on the clock and doing anything other than work, potential theft and misuse of time that's already been paid for, and yet nevertheless they're given leave to be able to do so. And the reason that's cited, which is really critical, the reason that's cited is that if they don't, we're concerned. We're concerned about perhaps the farmers not coming the next year, which is just the what that underscores is the reality that you can insist that something is a mitzvah and you can mandate that something is a law and you can say that you're obligated to bring the Bikurim. But if it's only a mandate and it's only obligatory, we may well find that the farmers just aren't going to come back the next year. It's just an amazing thing that if the mitzvos, if we don't do our part in making the mitzvos exciting, then you can only slam your fist on the table so frequently and demand that things are obligatory. But it's human nature that we tend to become more inspired and more excited about doing mitzvos and really just staying in the fold when there's beauty and when there's pageantry and when there's excitement to the mitzvahs that we do.
Given all the holidays that are coming up, is this something that you kind of take into account when you're thinking about programming for the holidays and what's going on?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, personally also, like the importance of going the extra mile, especially for kids, but this is... And clearly this is true of adults also. What this particular halacha detailing the Bikurim or that involves the Bikurim, what it really underscores is the fact that this applies to adults also. And the idea of, you know, beautiful sukkah makes it that much more enticing and creates a greater, you know, if we have the intellectual bond, then it creates a stronger emotional bond between ourselves and the mitzvos.
I think that's awesome, and I think it's a great lesson to take away from the Parsha this week. There's also, we can talk about the procession. There's also the actual content as reported in the Torah that they would give these baskets, and then they would make this declaration, which I think it's fascinating on, at least two levels. So many levels. But they would make this declaration of Arami Oved Avi, which is translated, can be translated in more than one way, but essentially we descend from, either we descend from idolaters, or as we talk about on the Pesach Seder, which is another interesting part of it, that an Aramean tried to kill my forefather. But either way, we kind of briefly tell the history of Israel up to that point, and sort of how my harvest this year ties into the exodus from Egypt. It seems so abstract to be like, oh yeah, you know, and then my great-grandfather did this, and then my father did that, and here I am today. And yet that's kind of what you're supposed to do. And it's brilliant. I mean,
it's so empowering.
Why do you say empowering?
Well, just because it removes you from just being this insignificant sort of blip on the radar screen of Jewish history, and it ties you back into that that sweeping narrative that that began it at a certain point and with a plan, with a purpose, and with scope and sequence to ultimately bring me here. It almost the person who's bringing his fruits can also almost view himself as being like this was for me. I mean, the sense of the depth of gratitude that you can experience, that it's not just my own life, and it's not just my little parcel of land, but like all of history has really brought us to this point, and all of God's planning and machinations have brought us to this point. I'm the center of it all.
You're really part of a plan. And I think about, like, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion in this past week, I think, or I've heard, you know, seen on Facebook, I've heard discussed in other places, like, how do we teach about September 11th to a generation that, you know, kids in high school today were not alive during the September 11th attacks?
Pretty wild.
And you know, there's a lot of questions like, well, what? How do we talk about it? What does it mean? You know, how is it framed? And the fact that, by and large, that day went on for me at work, for most people, I would imagine, without too much recognition of it. Without, you know, people, I think people remember, people heard it on the radio, but in terms of there's no national ritual, there's no observance, and of something which was so recent and so pretty pivotal. The idea that I'm just saying it to contrast with the fact that you have these national rituals and institutions that are set up to really plug you into your for you know, for the people of Israel, it's a religious culture, but also it's national culture with the people around you, with where you fit, like you say, like where you fit into the scheme of things, and that the things are, that the Exodus is remembered, that your heritage is remembered. It's so smart. I mean, we're talking about God's story here, but like when you contrast it to how the world generally commemorates things and how things fade from memory, and how, like, the idea of instituting ritual to plug people in and to really give a national culture and a national character, I think it underscores why it was so important, like you said, that people be able to take off from work to encourage this, why this is so, like, why it's so critical. It's not just a question of getting fruit down to the Beit HaMikdash, but it's a matter of, it's really a matter of instilling the national character. And what is that national character? It's gratitude. And that's so tremendous. The idea that you tell this whole story so that it leaves you with the sense that God has given you the bounty that you have, that you are not doing it by yourself, that you are not, it's not all on your own power, that you're not, you know, that you deserve all of the credit, but rather that you're dependent upon God, and that you share in that with everybody else.
It's the God of history, I think, is just so remarkable. Meaning that it's
right, the God of my crops is the God of history.
Right, that I could have a sense of gratitude for all of the blessings and all the bounty that God's bestowed upon me in within the parameters of my life, but this even removes you from just the, which in of itself is impressive, and which in of itself is meaningful, to be grateful to God for whatever it is that I have been blessed with in my own life. But to, I mean, this just blows the roof off that entire experience. And it says that it's so much broader than that. Meaning this isn't just that, you know, God brought you into this world, or that, you know, you met the right person who had the right fertilizer, who gave you the right advice to be able to plant this particular crop, and now here's the bounty, and he sent the rain when he needed to, and the sun when it was critical, when it was necessary. But that he rescued my ancestor generations ago from spiritual obscurity, and he brought him down to Egypt with his family, and then we faced physical oppression, and the totality of the narrative of the Jewish people really all leads to this moment. I think it's an interesting point that you make, that we do find so many rituals that, I guess, effectively erect the contours of what all of our holidays are like. And as much as it's true that, you know, well, it's, you know, obviously, you know, it's God and it's God's Torah, but I think it's interesting that we've then taken the same into the more recent, either rabbinic or even yet more contemporary holidays. When we think about, for better or for worse, when we think about Purim and Hanukkah, they are so marked by ritual. There are obligatory ceremonies that must take place in order to ensure that the holiday is actually kept properly and legally. And even on the flip side of things, I mean, we had it just a short while ago, Tisha B'Av. The Tisha B'Av is also this day that has tied us back into the full gamut of the historical perspective and the historical Jewish narrative. It's not just today, but today is really a function of everything that's come about over the course of the past 2,000 years. And then in a very contemporary sense, and not even necessarily religious one, it's so interesting that in the state of Israel today, something like Yom HaZikaron is marked by a ritual that the entire nation takes part in, that a siren blares and wherever you are, you stop and the traffic grinds to a halt. And there's really no opportunity almost to just allow the day to pass without saying that it's been marked and we've reflected on it in some capacity.
I think if you want to talk about sort of what is the genius of Jewish culture, I mean, constructing memory is I think kind of like where it's at in a certain sense. Like I think it's not good to speak broadly, especially I'm not an expert in every culture in the world, but I think that the way that the Jewish people construct memory, the way that we are, I mean, have you ever tried explaining Tisha B'Av to somebody who doesn't know what it is? The idea when you say like, yeah, we're going to spend the day reading mournful poetry over something which happened 2,000 years ago, and plus all of the other subsequent things that we're upset about. We just keep writing new poems. They're very flowery in Hebrew. We don't understand them that well, but we do it. And we're going to be on the floor in the dark, feeling miserable.
You Jews know how to partay
over things that happened hundreds of years ago. I mean, yeah, it's a
pretty steep buy-in.
You're
right, meaning that it's it's connective,
and I think when you see it, let alone experience it, it's maybe it's counterintuitive in terms of like, oh, this happened a long time ago, but like it's an obvious point to make, but it's like it's why we're still here, right. And it's amazing. All right, so moving on in the parsha, there's another decoration which gets far less play because we don't say it on Pesach. But it's like right afterwards, it says not only when you bring your first fruits to the temple, but also after all the tithes have been made, you give the portion of your crop to the Levi and you give a portion to the poor, that you make this declaration that says like, God, I did it. I gave everything. I didn't eat it. I didn't eat the food before I had made the contributions. I did everything properly. It's kind of amazing in the sense that like, I don't know. I think about, again, contrasting it with our lives today of like, what do you do after you file taxes? You hope you don't get audited. And yet this is like, you're like, I'm good, God. I'm ready. You can come check me out. And that's, again, it's like it's the difference between having a society which is based around God and the spiritual versus one where it's purely, purely legalistic. But the point is that like, I think it really, in a strange, I mean, or maybe not a strange way, but in a way it's really illustrative of the kind of society that Moshe is trying to describe, what their world is supposed to be like, that it's a world where you have where you're talking to God, where you are doing your civic duty, but it's your religious duty as well, and it's one that you can feel positive about, and you're plugged in. So much of Sefer Dvarim, from the halacha part of it to some of the ideas that Moshe is trying to impart, is really about I think painting this picture of what this land is supposed to look like, that he's not going to get to go with them, so he wants to tell them this is what you're trying to create. I'm leaving you with this image of what it is, and I think it comes through very, you know, this is kind of the end of this part of the speech, and it's quite moving.
There's another piece to this, another dimension to this. It's a beautiful idea. I actually just mentioned this thought this past week at a bar mitzvah. What's remarkable about this little passage is the way that it's referred to in the Gemara. This is what we refer to throughout the Talmud as vidui maiser. Vidui maiser literally means the confession of the tithes. What's odd about referring to this passage as the confession of the tithes, as you just pointed out, is that this is a declaration that you've done everything correctly. that you're squared away, that everything is good. When we think about a confessional and when we think about vidui, as we're about to approach during the period of reciting slichos and leading up to Yom Kippur, is, you know, you beat your chest and you talk about all the things that you've done wrong. That's what vidui is. Vidui is that I'm confessing my sins and I'm talking about what a terrible person I am, not how I've done everything correctly, at least with respect to this specific mitzvah. So Rav Soloveitchik explained that they're really two sides of the same coin, that vidui is more of an assessment than anything else. And it is impossible. And what basically the rabbis are trying to convey by referring to this declaration, by using the same term of vidui, what we might translate as a confession, is that your confession in how you've erred, in how you've done wrong, is meaningless if you don't own up to the fact that you could have done better. And the declaration that you could have done better is encapsulated here in this passage. Look, here is a moment in my life, here's a dimension of my life in which I've done everything correctly. And on the one hand, good for me, it's a pat on the back. On the other hand, it's something of a condemnation, because there's so much more that I could have done in so many other capacities that one vidui immediately translates into the other. One confession immediately becomes the next or leads into the next. But the idea of just beating the chest and, you know, the clopping and saying that I've done this wrong and that wrong and the other thing wrong, if where we are in terms of our headspace is that, yeah, because what do you want from me? I'm a human being. You know, I have failings. I have, you know, every human being has their foibles and their difficulties and their struggles. And I'm finite and I'm not perfect. And I have, you know, desires and interests and greed and pettiness. If that's where our headspace actually is, then it's not really a confessional. Confessional is that I can point just as easily to all the things that I've done right, which makes my recognition of that which I've done wrong actually mean something.
Sorry, I don't know if I follow. Where's the confession of what you did wrong here?
There is none.
Oh, okay. You just mean
the term is the same. Confessing
the good.
This passage is referred to throughout the Talmud as a confession of tithes, even though there's absolutely no mention of anything that you've done wrong.
I see. So the point that the term confession refers to the good and the bad.
That confession is, basically, we have to stop thinking about a confession as just sort of reciting as if from a script, because it is a script, but just reciting as if from a script that, okay, I did this wrong, this wrong, this wrong, this wrong, this wrong. But it's more of an attitude, meaning it's an attitude of self-reflection. It's an attitude of actually genuinely assessing what kind of person I am. And if I can only say that I've done all these things wrong without thinking about all the good that I've also done, then I'm not adequately assessing my talents in such a way so as to really put me on the hook and really make me responsible for the wrongdoing. So there needs to be both, especially this time of year, that if we only spend the time beating ourselves up and say, ah, we're so terrible, we're so horrible, if there isn't the sense of I'm so capable and I'm so talented and there's so much that I have done well that ought to be carrying over to other areas of my life, then the confessional, as we call it, is really meaningless.
I think that's really important in this period of self-assessment. I think it's also true in the sense that, you know, we're told not to be prideful, that it's a sin to have too much pride. And yet I remember that was always something you talked to us about in high school, that like, you're allowed to say I'm smart. You're allowed to say I'm capable. You're allowed to have confidence. You're allowed to, you know, the key is to have an accurate assessment of both your strong. Like if you're always putting yourself down.
If I'm incapable, I'm off the hook.
Right, and it's not helpful to being able to achieve anything at all if you are always, you know, yeah, exactly. You're you couldn't do any better. So, yeah. So the end of the parsha, or pretty much close to the end, consists of this just litany of terrible, terrible curses. And we've had this already earlier.
Yeah.
In which parsha is the
Bechukosai.
Okay. So we've already had this once. And we have it here again. I mean, is there a difference? It's a different generation hearing it. Is that what it is? Or is there something more? I mean, it's hard to pull out what the themes are.
What the specific distinctions may be. You know, you could go pusik by pusik, I suppose. It is interesting that on the one hand, we've sort of come to expect the fact that Moshe is going to repeat broad swaths of the Torah. On the other hand, not everything bears mentioning and bears repeating. And yet, the doom and gloom is repeated. And we've spoken about this before, that, you know, if there is no punishment and it's all just wine and roses, if what I do doesn't matter, if what I do isn't meaningful enough to be punished, then what's the point?
Yeah, and I think that is, you know, we get the so listeners may notice I've been quoting Rabbi Sacks a lot less lately, and it's because I didn't have his books on either Bamidbar or Devarim, and I just ordered them and got them, and what he says about the book in general, and you really see it here, is that Devarim is really about the, and it's, you know, just I'll read what comes at the end of all of these brief blessings and very, very long curses in Perek Chafchet Pasuk Samechtet. That's chapter 28, verse 69. Ela divrei habrit asher tziva Adonai et Moshe lichrot et bnei Yisrael be'eretz Moav milavad habrit asher karat itam b'chorev. These are the words of the covenant which Hashem commanded Moshe to make between the Jewish people in the land of Moab, aside from Milvad, in addition to the covenant which he made with them at Horeb, meaning at Mount Sinai. And the fact that this is almost, it's all reported from Moshe, and Moshe's making it, Rabbi Sacks interprets it as being a sign of maturity and readiness. In other words, at Mount Sinai, that covenant of, which is a, in itself is unique in history of God committing himself to a certain people and the people committing themselves to God, that there's a mutuality there, even though God obviously is infinitely superior and it's not a meeting or a deal of equals, but the people betray it immediately afterwards with the golden calf, and he sees this as being it coming around, that they're, it's the next generation, and they're either renewing or making a new covenant. It's essentially the same idea, though, but that the fact that the blessings and the curses, he talks about ancient treaties, and that there being when two ancient nations made a treaty, there were consequences for breaking the treaty that were written into the treaty, and that this is very much what we're seeing here. So I think it's very much in line with what you're saying, that it's important to talk about what the consequences are. It's important that there be consequences, that it's not just I like you and you like me, but we actually, it has to, there's got to be some real skin in the game. There's got to be something that we can lose by not keeping up our end of the bargain.
Yeah, I think it underscores that point exactly, that God has so much riding on us. And if he has so much riding on us, then if we fail, then it's a real failure. And that there's punishment, there are consequences to be had. But that's also, I mean, I used the word before, but it's empowering. Meaning it means that what we do really matters, that we have a huge responsibility, but also a huge opportunity to be able to draw God's presence down into this world, to be able to build a society on the other side, once we actually get there, on the other side of the Jordan, unlike anything that the world has ever known, and be able to really serve as God's ambassadors to the rest of the planet.
I think that I will have one more episode before Rosh Hashanah, but I think in preparation for the days of awe, I think that's an idea that should really fill us with awe, the idea that our mistakes matter, that God expects more from us, that it's really, I mean, it's, I guess, taken as a whole, this idea of the Bikurim, that the history really leads up to us, that we are the continuation of a grand design, of a link in a chain that leads up to us, and that our actions matter, and that there are consequences. I can't imagine a thought which can really should fill us with dread and awe in a deeper way than that. So I think that's a great place to stop, and something to meditate on this week leading up to the new year. The Portion Podcast is recorded in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, produced by Aaron Roller. Our theme music is The Magid's Niggin by Simply Tzfat. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends about it any way you can. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate us and leave a review, and you can follow the show on Facebook. We are sponsored by the Pravda Family Foundation. Have a good Shabbos, and remember, there is always more to learn.